So today, on the second day of the Munlam, we have these teachings. So, first of all, I would like to offer my greetings to Goshri Gyatsep Rinpoche, Mingyur Rinpoche, the Sangha, all the members of the Sangha, and all the faithful men and women who have gathered here today. To continue where we left off yesterday, the text reads, what it says in the text is, thus, becoming skillful from today onward in the methods of progressing toward Buddhahood itself is what we should call ambition. That is what we should call assertiveness. That is what we should call being good at what you do. In terms of being a practitioner, that is being learned. That is being venerable. That is what is called being a good master. That alone is the method for achieving Buddhahood swiftly. That is Abhidharma. That is the sutras. That is the Vinaya. That is listening, contemplating, and meditating. That is also bringing together all the arduous austerities and all your capabilities to accomplish Buddhahood. All the sutras and scriptures and classes of Tantra are from the verses of the Vinaya Bhikkhu Samaja, or Dharma for a single individual. They were taught with specific times and stages in mind. There are none that were not said to be unnecessary. In brief, the way that Geshe Poto understands it, being assertive. So he's saying what he understands assertive to means, and what he understands by being skilled or learned. Primarily, you could say being learned in the path to accomplish enlightenment. It means having the fortitude to achieve enlightenment. That is what should be called assertiveness. That is what should be called being skilled in means. Someone who's like that, not like that, but who's good at talking, and who spends their whole life growing old, talking until their hair turns white, that is not being learned. Being learned means knowing in the Dharma what should be taken up and what should be given up, and practicing it as you know it. That is what is called learned. And if you are like that, that is also being venerable. Venerable means keeping your vows well. That is also how being venerable should be understood. Being a good master, a good person, should be understood in just that way. The Abhidharma, the sutras, and the Vinaya are also exactly that. The teachings of the Abhidharma, sutras, and Vinaya do not transcend that. Someone who practices in this way is someone who is engaging in listening, contemplating, and meditating, and someone who just someone, if we look at them from the outside, they seem to have the appearance of someone who has studied and contemplated and who appears to meditate, but they have their own internal wild character. If that hasn't changed, if that doesn't change even in the slightness, then have they really done the practice of listening, contemplating, and meditating properly? They haven't. So in brief, everything that is taught in Dharma, or everything said in the Dharma, is to be put into practice. There is not even a single Dharma teaching that should not be put into practice. All the practices taught in the Dharma are solely methods for accomplishing Buddhahood. Ultimately, there are the stages for the three types of individuals, but ultimately, there's only the one method of achieving Buddhahood. For this reason, the teachings from starting from the verses on the Vinaya up through the highest teachings of Guhya Samaja, all of the Dharma that is taught, all of these are intended for a single, as a practice for a single individual. It's not like some need to practice some and don't need to practice others. That's not how it is. All dharmas are for practicing. There's not even a single letter that is not meant to be practiced for this reason. If you're going to achieve the state of Buddhahood, there's not a way to not know all of the different Dharma teachings. These days, what most people do is like they receive a short instruction, they know one short text, they study that one, and they think that just that one teaching is enough. And then they sit there complacently. If that's for all that was necessary, or if that was enough, then there'd be no reason for the Buddha to teach the three wheels of Dharma, would there? For that reason, if it were enough just to read one short teaching, there would have been no reason for the Buddha to teach 84,000 Dharma teachings. The reason why the Buddha taught the 84,000 Dharma teachings is that just that one short instruction is not enough. Generally, to achieve enlightenment, to achieve Buddhahood, you must never think that you've had enough, no matter what the Dharma is. You must never think it has been enough. And practicing in this way is extremely important. Otherwise, you could decide for yourself, okay, this is enough, I've learned enough. That's not right, that's not good. We don't even need to talk about achieving enlightenment. For example, like with a blacksmith, you know, like a metalsmith or someone who makes, you know, if you have a blacksmith or a silversmith, they want to make a bowl. They can't do it with only a single tool. They need many different tools. Likewise, you shouldn't think that a single pith instruction is enough to achieve Buddhahood. You shouldn't think it's like a snake shedding its skin. No. Snakes, when they go to a certain point, they shed their skin, right? They shed the old skin, they come out of the old skin. And so the whole old skin is left behind, right? And so we shouldn't think that it would be just as easy like that as if we were, you know, like shedding our own skin like a snake. Thinking in this way is a big mistake. So we need to be insatiable about learning and never be complacent about our practice for achieving Buddhahood. So Poto is saying we should practice all the Dharma teachings. When Lord Tsongkhapa was alive, he had a student who was a very learned student. He asked the student, what is the meaning of Kadampa? Please explain the meaning of the word Kadampa. And the student said, I don't remember his name, I'm sorry. But the student replied that it meant someone who practiced without leaving out even a single word of the Buddha, practicing all the pith instructions. That is what is meant by Kadampa. And when he said this, then Tsongkhapa said, oh, you've really taught me something important today. So Kadampa means taking everything, every single word that was taught by the Buddha, and using it as a method to tame your being, and then joining it into your body. For that reason, we should be insatiable in our listening, in our contemplation, in our meditation. We should never be satisfied in accomplishing virtuous activities. Now, to continue the text. So they were taught with specific times and stages in mind. There are none that were said to be unnecessary. All dharma is the same. If we say our dharma and their dharma, then criticize someone else's, we will be reborn in hell, it is said in the noble 8,000 verses. It is not right to think about any individual. All dharmas practice through intention, and we do not know what their intentions are. When we look at people who are focused on this life, it might seem as if they only accomplish things for this life, but there are some who have no thought at all of their own desires and do all they can for the sake of others, sentiments. There are those who say they are benefiting others but are accomplishing their own aims. Accomplishing one's own aims can also be of benefit to others. Some say it is impossible to have no wishes, but the fault is in their own mind. What this is saying in general is that if we are genuinely practicing the Dharma, that we shouldn't be clinging to any particular group or any particular lineage. We wouldn't say, I'm a member of the group, and then become really attached to that group. We shouldn't say, oh, I'm a member of this lineage, and then cling to that. Having such a bias is, forget about having such a bias. We shouldn't even dream about having such a bias. And the reason for this comes down to is our death and impairments. We don't stay still even a moment. Each instant we get closer to death. And after we have died, we will definitely cycle through the suffering of samsara over and over again. If we do not do whatever we can to free ourselves from samsara, we will cycle through it over and over again like a windlass spinning and breathe continuously. And this is certain. For that reason, now, if we can achieve liberation and animations now, this is the time. We've come to the time to achieve it. If in terms of liberation and omniscience, what we need to do, first of all, is rouse the uncontrived intention to bring all sentient beings to the state of Buddhahood. We need to rouse aspirational bodhicitta, right? Once we have roused aspirational bodhicitta, we shouldn't just leave that as a wish. We need to put it into practice, definitely need to put it into practice. If we do not bring it into practice, then we will never develop engaged bodhicitta in our beings. Without rousing engaged bodhicitta, there is no way we can achieve Buddhahood in this lifetime. As thus, this uncontrived resolve that we must do something to benefit sentient beings is like the foundation or the basis. In order to develop such aspirational bodhicitta of thinking you must do something to benefit all sentient beings, what you first have to do is assemble all the causal conditions for it. It doesn't arise without causes or conditions. And the cause and conditions is that that you have to develop is the four immeasurables without any bias toward any sentient beings. If you develop, in order to develop the, when you develop the four immeasurables in your being, what happens then is that hopes for your own group will prevail and thoughts that the other group will fail cannot possibly occur. So as Geshe Botowa understood it, in Tibet these days there probably isn't anyone who has developed the four immeasurables in their being. Generally, the four immeasurables are held in common with non-Buddhists as well. Even they practice the four immeasurables. If you do not develop the four immeasurables, then you cannot even attain the worldly first and second jhanas. Forget about Buddhahood. So in this day and age, to pretend that you can achieve Buddhahood without even developing the four immeasurables is fooling others, and it's fooling yourself. And this is a really pitiful situation. Generally, the Buddha himself predicted how his teachings would be destroyed. He said that non-Buddhists and demons had no ability to destroy his teachings. They have no power to destroy his teachings. They're primarily strife among those who uphold the teachings due to their afflictions that would destroy his teachings. Primarily, this means strife within the Sangha, conflict in the Sangha, the holders of the teachings being in conflict, saying, we are in accord with the Dharma, they are not. We are pure, they are not. By doing this, the teachings will be destroyed by internal conflict, the Buddha said. So for this reason, it is crucial that we be extremely careful. In any case, these days, the Buddhism is like clouds dissipating in the sky. At first, you know, there are a lot of skies, but then Kali, very slowly, slowly, they gradually disappear. And this is the time that we have arrived at. We need to be extremely careful. Even if we cannot become beings who uphold the teachings, at the very least, we must not be individuals who destroy the teachings. Whether or not we are individuals who destroy the teachings is, from one perspective, it's quite easy. These days, we're in the information era. In the past, we'd have conversations with just our friends and acquaintances, but nowadays, we send them out all over to the social media to all sorts of people. Well, there are many messages that denigrate great beings, or that denigrate Dharma lineages. And so even if we don't originally, you know, normally feel much involvement, if we get involved with them, so first of all, we don't usually feel much bias, but when we hear these, then we develop bias and attachment. And when that happens, we get into conflict. And eventually, that becomes the cause for destroying the teachings. So I think this is something that everyone must be very careful of. In brief, Potoha himself says here, it is not right to talk about any individual. It is not okay to say whatever you want about any individual. The reason is that with Dharma, whatever our situation might be, the Dharma depends upon our own individual practice of it and the way we think. We cannot understand what other people's knowledge and intent is, or whether they have any Dharma practice in their being. We can't know that. If one is only interested in this life, then we'll see everyone else as only being interested in just this life, due to our own imprints and habits. We will see everyone else as doing things just for the sake of this life. And when we look out there, it might seem as if someone's acting only for the sake of this life, but though we see them like that, in the actuality, they might really be solely working for the benefit of others. It's quite possible this happens. So for this reason, our perceptions are sometimes not that reliable. We can't really rely on our own perceptions. There are many situations where we are deceived by our perceptions. For that reason, in appearance, someone might seem to like they have faults, but in actuality they don't. It's quite possible. There are many stories about the great practitioners of the past. For example, Nirupasatelapani, burning live fish, you know, like taking live fish and roasting them in the fire. Likewise, in Milarepa's life story, Marpa is someone who's like, you'd have to say, someone who has a really bad character. There's someone here who really completely trusted, who devoted himself entirely to him. And look how much difficulty he gave Milarepa. If there were a lama like Marpa these days, it would be like on WeChat, it would have been posted to all of the WeChat Mopeds, and everyone said, Marpa did that today, he did this today. Marpa wouldn't have been able to like show his own face. for this reason. Something might seem to like a fault from the outside, but we really need to degree to what degree it actually is. And so it's very important for us to be careful, he is saying. So now we will continue with the text. Some say you need wealth only in order to truly practice Dharma. If you lack resources, you need to curry favor with others, but you will not need to if you have your own wealth. Therefore, having a few things is an aid to the Dharma, they say. But none of them have thought about death. That is what someone who has not gained certainty in death would say. If you do not truly think of and recall death from your heart, the Dharma will never happen. If you do genuinely recall death, how could you bear it mentally? At that point, how could you have any desire to amass things? What this is saying, when we say some people, so some individuals, is that if you want to genuinely practice Dharma, you need to have some resources, they say. You need some wealth, some prosperity, a little bit of influence. And if you don't have those, you can't practice the Dharma. Because if you don't have them, you'll have to curry favor with other people, with your patrons. If you have your own resources, you won't have to depend upon anyone else or curry favor them. You'll be able to pull yourself up by your own bootstraps. So they say that having some resources of your own is an aid and a condition for practice Dharma, not an impediment. There are many people who give such advice, but that isn't right. That's no good. And the reason is, if you say you can't practice Dharma without resources, it's like saying you can't practice Dharma, you can't even think about the Dharma when you have no resources. If you have no money, you can't practice, you think, and thinking that way is no good at all. The reason is that if you say you won't practice Dharma now when you don't have any resources, then later, when you do have many resources, there's the danger you'll start saying that when you do have resources, that then you'll only do wrong and you won't practice any Dharma. For this reason, in these days, the more wealthy and the more influential you get, the less Dharma activity you accomplish and the stronger your accumulation of misdeed becomes. Especially these days. It's like this in many monasteries. When we say we're doing things to benefit the teachings, it means building a large monastery and building statues of the Buddhas that are bigger than in any other monastery, that are so and so, such and such many stories high, and saying we used this many kilos of gold and silver. You guys are. So people will boast like this. Is that really Dharma activity? You can't say that it definitely is Dharma activity. Genuine Dharma activity is doing whatever we can to get out of samsara and to bring others happiness. That is what Dharma activity means. What we need to do in order to free ourselves from samsara is listening, contemplating, and meditating. The practice of listening, contemplating, meditating is genuine or actual Dharma activity. Comparing or competing between monasteries in size or in wealth is not. Now to continue with the text. Some people reply, they will use their wealth until they die, and then whoever wants it can take it when they die. These are exactly what I call people who are focused on this life. They may have their own wealth and may not need to curry favor with others, But it is certain none of these practitioners will ever practice better than they do now. One needs to put up with a few hardships to achieve perfect Buddhahood. When you buy a large gemstone, you need to put up your own money, collateral, and an additional amount. There's no point in them knowing much about Dharma. There's no point in profound oral instructions either. When you meet a good guru, your mind will likely become the Dharmakaya. And so the meaning of this passage is, so what some people say is, so now you need to gather some wealth and some resources, and as long as you live, you should use it as like a support or an aid to your Dharma practice. And if you have students, they also need some resources. They need food to eat, they need clothes for their backs. And so you have to have a little bit. So you use it until you die, and then after you die, well, let whoever takes it, it makes no difference to me. I've put it out of mind, I've given it away. And so there are people who speak like this. Poltava says, this is a wrong way of speaking. It's not at all good. And the reason is that in his understanding, exactly that is being focused on this life. Speaking like that is exactly about focusing on this life. The reason is that it's not remembering death. People say, until I die, I'll use my resources for myself and my students. The text says, one needs to put up with a few hardships to achieve perfect Buddhahood. And so what that means is, that in these days is that we can't even do the tiniest, we can't even bear the tiniest hardships for the sake of achieving perfect Buddhahood. There's just a little bit of hardship, we can't bear the thought of it. When it comes to achieving the lower realms, though, if we have to spend money, we'll do it. If we have to give away our land and our fields, we'll do it. If we have to work all day and night without even time to eat, with inadequate clothing, with no time for sleep, you know, whether it's hot or cold, just accepting all of these sufferings, we're happy to do it. So for that reason, just as to say that you know a lot of the Dharma is not, doesn't help at all. Saying it's pith instructions are profound doesn't help. As the text says, when you meet a good guru, your mind will likely become the Dharmakaya. So what we need is that if merely knowing a lot of Dharma doesn't help, and saying you have a lot of profound instructions does not help, then what we really need is to meet an unmistaken guru, a qualified guru. The reason is that if we meet an unmistaken, a qualified guru, so it's like, for example, if you're a merchant, the merchant would have a lot of goods, right? Goods for sale. And the merchant will get a good dog to guard guard their goods, to protect the merchandise, to protect them and watch over them whether any thieves are coming. And if a thief comes, the thief will, you know, bark and give an alarm. So good guru will know whether you're having thoughts that are dharmic or that are non-dharmic. And if non-dharmic thoughts occur, they'll say, hey, having thoughts like that is not good. They'll stop you and you'll be able to immediately block those bad thoughts. You'll be able to gang up on and block those thoughts. You'll be able to do this. So these days, when we say, so as it says here, when you meet a good guru, your mind will likely become the Dharmakaya. So these days, what people say is, there's no need to block, you don't need to gang up and block bad thoughts. If the afflictions arise, you don't need to stop them forcefully the moment they arise. That's not necessary. They'll be liberated within emptiness. Oh, let them arise, let them occur. They'll be liberated within emptiness, they say. There are many who say this. But this is a complete falsehood. The reason is because if you're able to rest within emptiness, it's impossible that thoughts of popularity in this life or prosperity in this life will ever occur. If you're intoxicated by popularity and wealth in this life, if you're only thinking about them, and you're like you're drunk with them, and saying, well, they'll be liberated in emptiness, then all your pretenses of resting in emptiness are a complete lie. This is what he's saying. So all of such talk is like, it's like with not lacking any confidence or basis for confidence and saying really impresses highfalutin Dharma talk. But in actuality, you haven't got even a single quality of the Dharma, any even a tiniest bit of one in your being. So with that, all such talk is a falsehood. This is for all of us, as usual. And in particular, it's for everyone, but especially for those of us who call ourselves Dharma practitioners. We need to be very careful to examine our own beings. We need to know what our own mind stream is actually like. It shouldn't be like some sort of conceit. or something that we hope it might be like. It shouldn't be some sort of like a dream that we have that it might be like. That doesn't help. We need to actually examine our own beings and see what our real situation is. This examination is critically important. And for us Dharma practitioners, our primary responsibility is to examine ourselves. This is what's most important. I mentioned this yesterday. We need to examine ourselves, analyze what within us is not appropriate. After we've examined ourselves and identified our bad points, then we need to do what we can to abandon them. We have to try to fix them. And so, please everyone, keep this in your minds. So that is probably enough for today. And so next we'll recite the aspiration for the stages of the path and so forth. So this year, even though I didn't have the opportunity to actually attend this Kaiju Monem, it feels like as if I have actually come regardless of the distance. Even if my body isn't there, it feels to me like my mind is. And so for all of you who are attending the Monem, the members of the Sangha and the members of the public, there are quite a few people. Despite me not coming, quite a few people have come. And I'm really delighted about this. And the reason is because when we practice the Dharma, and so if you say, oh, I can't come, and you say, oh, this time the Karmapa's not coming, well, the Karma's not coming, so maybe I won't go. From one perspective, that's fine. But from another perspective, it's not at all good. And the reason is that whether we need to practice the Dharma or not is a point that comes down to ourselves. You aren't practicing the Dharma to keep me happy, are you? If something is beneficial for you, and it's an important point for you, then practicing it is your responsibility. You shouldn't just be doing it to keep someone else happy, or to keep an eye on, or while keeping an eye on someone else's condition. And this is a situation where you have to take responsibility for yourself and accomplish your own good. So I'm delighted that so many of you have come. The most important thing is that this Kaiju Monem is not a theater or a stage for me as a single individual. Originally, Khyabje Kala Rinpoche and Khyabje Boko Rinpoche planted the seeds for it here in India, and then it has a historical basis that in the time of the 7th Karmapa Chöde Gyatso there was the Garchen Monem. So this Monem is something that needs to be preserved from generation to generation. And preserving it does not mean only preserving the rituals or the traditions. That's not just that. The main thing we need to preserve is the courage that comes from aspirations. We need to make this essential thing the reason to preserve the Monem. When we recite these aspirations and see the aspirations that were made by the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, the aspirations that were made by the gurus of the past, it really inspires us, doesn't it? Look at all the aspirations they made for the sake of sentient beings who fill all of limitless space. Likewise, look at all the hardships they underwent. And when we see those, even though we are oppressed by all our afflictions and faults, and even though we're oppressed by all our afflictions and faults, when we see those prayers, we think that I'm going to try hard to do this. And try hard, and even though we're oppressed by thousands of afflictions, we think, I'm going to do this, and it really inspires. This is extremely important for us to preserve that courage and that inspiration. And if we can preserve that, Only then can we accomplish the aspirations of the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas. When I say a Bodhisattva, sattva means a hero, means someone with courage, a hero. And the reason Bodhisattvas are heroes is because they are indomitable in accomplishing the good of other sentient beings. Benefiting other sentient beings is not easy. I've had some experience, and you also have had a fair amount yourself, about how difficult it is to benefit anyone in this life. And that is only temporary benefit and happiness in this life. We can only bring temporary benefit and happiness. But if you need to accomplish all benefits, both temporary and ultimate, if you don't have inconceivable courage, then there's absolutely no way to accomplish it. So how can we gain such courage? It doesn't come without any cause. Such courage doesn't come spontaneously. That courage comes from taking the way the Buddhas of the past and the Lamas of the past aroused bodhicitta as an example for ourselves. Also, read the life stories of the master of the past. They aren't myths. The Lamas actually came into this human realm. They were just like us. They were born. They died. They were living beings. And so when we read their life stories, then only then we think, oh, they were human. And they're able to do all that. And even if we can't be just like them, we get inspired to try to be like them, if not exactly the same. So please, everyone, keep that in mind. And so we'll leave it here for today. Thank you very much.